Public Safety Subcommittee for Tuesday, April 12, 2005. Continuing a hearing on House Bill 5016, Department of Corrections. And we are going to take up where we left off yesterday with the Transitional Services Division and Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for Transitional Services. And good afternoon, Director Williams and Ms. Martin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and thank you very much again for the committee's time today to talk more with you about our Phase 2 budget presentation. We have a busy agenda for you today, assuming that it is the Chair's wish. Ms. Martin is going to complete her discussion on the Transitional Services Division today, and then we have both the Assistant Director for Human Resources and our Assistant Director of General Services here, along with the Deputy Director, Mitch Morrow, to present briefly some overview information for you about the three respective areas of the budget that we have remaining to talk to you about today. We hope to complete that, obviously, in the time we have remaining with you this afternoon in advance of the public testimony tomorrow. So with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Martin to pick up where we left off yesterday. And we'll obviously – oh, I should also point out that we have provided to the committee the copy of the testimony on Senate Bill 704 that has all of the pages of testimony, not just that first page. And the other questions that you posed yesterday that the committee posed, we recorded and have identified, and we are in the process of doing the research and collecting the information. We'll provide those to you hopefully before the end of the week, and then we'll be prepared to discuss those with you in more detail at the work session.
Very good.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the committee. I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, responsible for transitional services. I'd like to finish up with the cognitive programs briefly and then move on to alcohol and drug treatment programs within the Transitional Services Division.
And so we're on page 10.
We are on page 10.
Okay.
The governor's budget has proposed a reduction of $500,000 in cognitive programs and $275,000, which eliminates the Women in Community Service program. These are both in our cognitive programs area. We will take a portion of those reductions in the cognitive programs by eliminating the program we found to be ineffective in our research. The Breaking Barriers program was not having an impact on recidivism, and so by eliminating that program and reinvesting the resources that were used there, we can reduce by $500,000 our budget and also invest slightly in a program which we found to be more effective. There are 3,300 inmates at any particular time who are high risk for criminality and high risk because of their antisocial thinking. These are the folks that we will be targeting in our cognitive programs. In any particular three-month period, the program is 3 months long, the needed treatment capacity is 464. I wanted to clarify that so that it was clear that the treatment capacity is not the same as the number of inmates who need that kind of service. Moving on to alcohol and drug treatment programs.
Before you do that, you mentioned the Women in Community Service program and the cut there. Could you also speak to the effectiveness of the Women in Community Service program?
Yes, Madam Chair. The Women in Community Service program was found to be effective in our latest research. Our research department found that the WICS program reduces recidivism by nearly 23%. Earlier studies found no effect, but this latest one did show a significant effect. The program is a...
Madam Chair, could you... So you're saying... Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're saying the 1.3 cut by the governor does not affect, will not adversely affect the program?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wiesent, that program would be eliminated in the governor's budget, the Women in Community Service program.
I didn't understand you saying that.
I would like to hear some comment from Director Williams on the impact of eliminating a program that has proven effective and that serves a population that has historically been underserved, in our correctional system. Certainly you must be troubled by that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, obviously we're always disappointed when a program that is demonstrating effectiveness is being reduced. We have and know what programs can and are effective in the system, and so it is sometimes an issue about allocating resources between more or less effective programs. I think one of the points that that led to this reduction, as you well know, budgets are put together well in advance as the timeline moves forward. The data that we received on the WICS program on the most recent research that has been done, which I think is the most thorough research that's been done on the program, was received probably after the cut identifications had been made with respect to this program. So, nothing is ever sort of a final. Everything moves along a continuum, and decisions were made about recommendations on program effectiveness, and new information has come forward since then that shows that this program does have an effectiveness that is substantial and is a contributing program, obviously, to the programs in place at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. So our preference, obviously, would be to not see any of these programs cut. We recognize that we are one piece of a broader budget that has to be allocated, and decisions have to be made, and cuts had to be identified, and we understand that, but disappointed, obviously.
I would ask you to look at where else you might cut in order to bring back that $275,000 program.
And Madam Chair, as I mentioned before, we'll be happy to have those conversations. We're having them as well with the Governor's Office, and can proceed perhaps collectively in conversations about that as we move towards work session.
Let's do that.
Okay. Moving on now to alcohol and drug treatment programs. These programs make up 0.5% or 1% of the Department of Corrections budget. However, most of the funding now is provided through the Inmate Welfare Fund, over 80% of the funds used to provide alcohol and drug treatment programs. Our alcohol and drug treatment services are designed to address the most serious alcohol and drug dependency problems in the highest risk inmates. You may be familiar with the statistics on alcohol and drug problems in the corrections population. 76% of individuals in prison have an alcohol and drug problem, and obviously we're not able to reach each and every one of those, so we do focus our services on the more severely impacted, both in terms of the severity of their addiction problem and also the degree to which the addiction problem is connected to their criminal behavior. So we're doing that kind of an assessment now to help us better target. Substance abuse is directly related to criminality in 2/3 of the men coming into our system, and over 80% of our new female admits. So it's a big factor driving crime, both drug crime, of course, and also most property crime is driven by alcohol and drug addiction. In terms of the effectiveness study that was conducted, the alternative incarceration program was looked at. That's our new program that combines an intensive alcohol and drug treatment program in Baker City and at Coffee Creek, and allows for an earlier release for folks that are successful in that program. It's too early for us to have recidivism data on that particular alcohol and drug treatment program, but we do estimate that there will be $4.8 million in savings to the prison system this biennium and $6.1 million in savings next biennium. These reductions are already accounted for in the corrections population forecast, however, so it doesn't give you any more dollars to move around. We also looked at alcohol and drug treatment that was provided in the prison system in 2001. Our recidivism data, you may remember, is always 3 years behind, so we're looking at how the system was functioning 3 years ago. In 2001, we had some less intensive educational and pre-treatment kinds of programs, as well as our residential programs. Those less intensive programs were not found to be effective. However, at this point, we have eliminated those programs based on the national research that indicates that less intensive programs don't have the kind of effect we want with the kind of people we're treating. They did find a very small positive effect with our residential programs. although our researchers tell me that
Representative Wisnot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you need to clarify that for me. Did you compare? Was this comparing a prison population? The less intensive study that you said the less intensive treatment was not successful. And was that? Are we looking at the same sort of population? Was it a prison in population or a community population?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnot, the research folks tried to match the treatment group and the non-treatment group as exactly as they could. So these are all inmates being compared to other inmates who scored in similar ways for age, demographics, risk to reoffend, that sort of thing. However, our research unit is still concerned about their ability to create a proper matched group for our residential programs. We would have expected to see a more positive effect from the residential treatment. And so they are also, in addition to doing this retrospective study looking at 2001 activity, they are also conducting a prospective study in which they're doing a random assignment of some people going to treatment and some people going to a non-treatment group to find out in a more, I guess, a more statistically solid way what impact our programs are having. There are hundreds, literally, of studies of correctional treatment programs that nationally that show that this is a good investment in the correction system, and so it would be unusual if we also didn't receive the same kinds of benefits to our system. So we'll continue to look at that. The budget drivers for our prison programs obviously are the growth in the prison population, as well as our, I think, growing sense of responsibility for accurately and carefully preparing people to live successfully when they leave prison by reducing their criminal risk factors while they are with us. The governor's budget has included a reduction in our alcohol and drug treatment programs of $2 million. We anticipate reducing our programs starting with the least intensive first, and that would mean we would be eliminating 95 beds of day treatment for men. This is our slightly less intensive level of treatment than the residential treatment. Moving on. Okay. Religious services is the next major unit within the Transitional Services Division. It makes up one half of 1% of the DOC budget. Religious services conducts an array of faith-based kinds of programs, including worship, studies, hospice and death ministry, pastoral counseling, and faith-based transition programs. 52% of those in prison will at some point during the year attend a religious services activity. The religious services unit also operates our volunteer program. We have over 1,800 volunteers throughout the Department of Corrections, providing over 100,000 hours of service each year. That is equivalent to over 50 full-time staff. Three-quarters of these volunteers help provide worship and other religious services. The remainder are providing self-help groups like Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous and other pro-social activities that help structure inmate time during the time that they're incarcerated. The religious services unit manages the victim information notification every day, or VINE system, which is an automated service for crime victims that provides notification when an inmate in prison or jail or in the community moves or changes in status in some way. Over 14,000 Oregonians have already registered to be part of VINE and to be notified, and each month 700 to 800 additional new people register. The VINE system has delivered nearly 12,000 notifications to registered crime victims in 2004. Community-based...
Ms. Martin, do we have any information that tells us how effective that system of notification is?
Madam Chair, I'm not clear how we would know about effectiveness in terms of reaching the person notified.
I'm not either.
Okay.
Just trying to probe here and understand. It's an automated system.
Correct.
Notifying victims when their offender is getting out of...
Madam Chair, the system is automatic. It pulls data from our statewide information system and from jail information systems and automatically notifies by calling the number given by the crime victim. It continues to call the number automatically until the crime victim receives the call and gives a code that says they've received the message. So I think they've set it up in a way that they're pretty sure that crime victims do get notified when they've registered.
What's the content of the message? Give me an example.
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure how the message is worded.
If I could, Madam Chair, I believe, though, the message contains the salient information about that this individual is either being released or might be moving from one institution to another institution. So it would have the basic information about who the offender was and that this was a call based on the victim's registration in the VINE system, and here's the notification, and it gives the basic information about the move. And then I suspect, and again, I'm guessing on this point, but I suspect that it also gives a number if they have further questions that they can call and make an inquiry to.
That's correct.
So it gives them the opportunity to get further information if they need it. But it is dependent upon the victim actually choosing to register. And so this is in conjunction with the Victims Assistance Office at the Attorney General's office and then the County Victims Assistance Offices that are usually in cooperation with the district attorneys, where this is made available and people can then at that point fill out the materials and register to become part of the VINE network.
Please continue.
Okay. The Religious Services Unit has been developing a reentry program in this last biennium, which consists of a network of volunteer community chaplains and other community volunteers who are interested in working with inmates as they transition to the community. It's a way of tapping into the faith community and assisting us with our basic mission to improve transition. They connect inmates to services, provide pro-social kinds of support and mentoring to inmates as they leave. At this point, we have 30 to 35 volunteer community chaplains who are working with us, as well as community coordinators who are volunteers that help connect inmates with services in the community. And they're also working closely, of course, with the probation parole officers that provide the supervision. The program was awarded the National Award for Best Chaplaincy Programs by the American Correctional Chaplains Association in 2005.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Martin, I'm sorry. Do you have statistics on, you know, like, does 40%, 50% of the prisoners utilize this program? To me, this is an important part of the process. If we don't, you know, get them a job or, you know, get them back on in counseling, you know, they're gonna be right back. And so, to me, this is an important stage in the correction process. And can we require them to go in, or is it volunteer? And
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a voluntary program, and it's just getting off the ground. But it has assisted 260 inmates in the last 6 months. It is, because it is a faith-based program, it needs to be a voluntary program for folks who are comfortable receiving that kind of support. And it is just one of the transition activities that we provide through the Department of Corrections. We, as an agency, of course, agree with your statement that that's probably one of the most important things we do is prepare people to live in the community and then successfully transition them to both the services and the supervision that they will be receiving in the community.
Thank you.
I would suggest that this is another area where we need to look at a performance measure. This is a new effort with a small population participating.
Need to work on that product design.
And it is a part of the Oregon accountability model. And so, again, I would think that we need to look at developing a performance measure that is tied to how this faith-based reentry initiative works. Mr. Wilson, if you can make a note of Where's your hat? Okay.
The fourth major unit of the Transitional Services Division is the Offender Information and Sentence Computation Unit. This unit makes up 0.8% of the DOC budget. It's responsible for assuring that the release dates set for inmates are accurate and up-to-date, and this is especially important not just because it's important that offenders serve their time, but it's also necessary to do good release planning. You have to have a firm date that you know that person will be leaving prison so that you can coordinate care and supervision. This unit also maintains all of the inmate paper records and archives all records for every felony offender in Oregon, including probationers, and also provides information to the public.
Manager.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I think this is a good area to ask the question. I have just got a constituent request. If you're not a Measure 11, you get points for good behavior. But the way the current law reads is it can only be one-third of your sentence reduced. Is that part of this calculation?
Madam Chair, Representative, the current law allows for up to 20% of a sentence reduction because of good behavior. And it is part of the work that this unit performs based on the assessment done by the corrections counselor.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
We're talking non-Measure 11 inmates. If we increase that to 33% or, you know, one-third, do you think we could eliminate a lot of our inmates or reduce our inmate? Is that...
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, that's actually interesting that you should raise that issue. This is a conversation that is occurring right now in the Senate Judiciary Committee. They're having a hearing on a bill that is proposing to do just that. And I think it's safe to say that, yes, if you increase the amount of non-Measure 11 earned time, you would over time reduce inmate population. I think that there are a variety of policy issues that are worthy of discussion on that point. But I think you would find that there are some who strongly support that notion and there are others who strongly oppose it based on the philosophy that it violates the principle of truth in sentencing and a variety of other principles. So this is a policy discussion, frankly, that we're having other people from the department attend and provide information on today, particularly the detailed information about how good time is actually accounted for and earned. Within the system, so that is a conversation that's ongoing.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Madam Chair, before we leave the this issue, I'm wondering, when an inmate leaves, when employees leave, we do exit interviews. When an inmate leaves, do we have that kind of conversation? Is there any kind of data taken from them, their last days?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, it's interesting that you should raise that issue. In the planning we're doing right now for the development of our strategic plan, we've been identifying a number of internal management measures that we think would be helpful for us as to knowing whether or not we are or aren't accomplishing all that we've set out to do. And the idea of some amount of post-prison inquiry is one of the issues that we are considering. There is always a certain hesitancy, I think, on the part of those who are currently incarcerated to feel like if they talk too much, they might somehow get recrimination as a result of that. So the population that we primarily would need to work with is the population that's actually at that point been released out. And we've talked about a variety of ways of doing that. And there's some extremely valuable information that we think over time we could gather, both about program effectiveness and a variety of other issues. And so we intend and I would tell you that we do some of that now. Some of the retrospective research that we do on program effectiveness and the like is done by contacting individuals who were incarcerated and have since been released. So that's done on a more limited scale, but there isn't a standard post-prison exit interview that's conducted.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. As we continue to have performance measure conversations and how we go about that, those, I'm not sure you would call those customer interviews, but of a sense they are, because they are the population being served. And as we continue to have that conversation, understanding that there could be differences in the way it's viewed, but we might gather good information. And so I commend that we're talking about
it. And we are. And we'd be pleased to share more details individually with the committee if they're interested in some of what we've been thinking about.
Interesting subject. Please continue.
Next section in this presentation on page 12, use of professional services and contracts. We provide education through contracts with local community colleges. Our alcohol and drug programs, cognitive programs, and parenting skills programs are provided through contractual relationships with nonprofit treatment agencies. The community corrections part of our business, contracts for inspection of local correctional facilities, and in our state offices, we contract for offender treatment programs, for jail beds, and offender services and sanctions that are used locally in each of those systems.
I have a question. On the interagency agreements with local community colleges, are we, serving on the education subcommittee, with Representative Wisnot, we heard interesting testimony today, public testimony from various community colleges around the state, and they're all looking at some form of cutbacks in various adult basic and skills development courses, the very courses that you're listing here. What kind of conversations are going on between corrections and community colleges that tell us what that future is going to look like, the future for these kinds of contracting opportunities and cooperative agreements?
Madam Chair, we are now in contract negotiation for 0507, and at this point it looks like we'll be able to maintain the current level of service that we have available in the institutions through the contracts.
Are you comfortable with what you'll be able to do around ESL, for example, given the population you have in the prisons needing that particular piece, and again looking at the cutbacks that community colleges tell us you're going to be taking?
Madam Chair, I believe that we are successfully meeting our ESL educational requirements. We are not serving every person who needs adult basic education. And so at our current level of service, while we're not losing any service, as I was mentioning yesterday, we're not able to reach every one of those people. So we're looking at about 66% right now.
Yeah, I would just ask that you keep us informed, and through the interim, you just keep us informed about how this piece is actually working out. Very concerned based on the testimony today.
Moving on to cost control measures. A couple of things we've done that I think control our costs or allow us to work within our existing resources in a more efficient way. In the Educational Services Division, we have increased our use of computer-based learning labs, which allows us to continue some kind of educational activity in institutions in which we can't put full-service educational services. So, for example, in our releasing institutions, a couple of our releasing institutions have computer learning labs and some instructional assistance, which allows inmates who are close to release to continue to work on their GED, where they wouldn't have that available to them if they were depending on a full-service site. For our alcohol and drug treatment programs and our COG programs, as more cost-effectiveness measure, we know that we need to target those individuals who are at higher risk because that's where we get the greatest reduction in recidivism. Also, we privatize those kinds of services, and we believe that that brings us both a quality of care and a good value for our alcohol and drug treatment and our cognitive programs. I mentioned earlier a volunteer program that brings in the equivalent of about 50 staff hours that assist us in various places in the department. And particularly in the religious services area. On page 15, there are three performance measures that Transitional Services Division contributes toward. One of those, the first of those, is measure number 2, the percentage of inmates in compliance with the 40-hour work education requirements of measure 17. Programs that remove the barriers to employment are the ones offered by Transitional Services Division. So providing a credential or some basic education, treating addiction, teaching self-management skills, all of those kinds of activities count toward Measure 17 compliance, and they also contribute to the ability of the workforce to be competent both inside the prison and when they release. Performance measure number 3 is percentage of an inmate's corrections plan completed while at DOC. And before I talk about that one, I wanted to talk a moment about what a corrections plan is. When an inmate comes into the intake center, they go through a pretty thorough assessment, which includes an assessment of the criminal risk factors, such as addiction or poor vocational or educational achievement or antisocial thinking, that contribute to their criminal behavior. And they are then matched to available interventions within the prison, and this is essentially the corrections plan. So it starts with the criminal risk factor and matches that with an intervention. We set a baseline figure for this measure in 2003 at 68%, and in 2004 was 64%. One of the reasons for that is we've eliminated some of our less intensive programs in A&D and in COG that were treating lots of people, but were not having the kind of effect that we desired. So in the alcohol and drug area, we used to offer alcohol and drug education. We found that that was not effective, and so we no longer offer that as a intervention in the plan. And we'll continue to need to watch that particular measure as our services become more and more targeted on the highest risk people. It's possible that that percentage will drop as we need to adjust the resources we have available to those who most need intervention. And then the third performance measure to which Transitional Services contributes is the percentage, that's number 5, percentage of offenders on post-prison supervision convicted of a felony within 3 years of release from prison. This has been a state benchmark since the benchmarks were created. The state benchmark is set at 28.8%. This recidivism number was met one time in 1994, which may be the explanation about why that's the particular measure. Our current rate is 30.5%, meaning about a third of those inmates released from prison in the first 6 months of 2001 recidivated. Recidivating means they were convicted of a felony crime within 3 years of release. It doesn't necessarily mean that they returned to prison. So about two-thirds of them returned to prison, and the other third remain in community. The recidivism rate, while not meeting the 28.8% state benchmark, has been slowly trending down in the last couple of years. We do expect that the changes made in the prison system recently and in community corrections to apply the research on reducing recidivism should make some measurable difference in our recidivism rates over time. For example, the fact that we are now assessing inmates for criminal risk factors and addressing those factors should make a difference, and the fact that community corrections is on the same track and engaging in the same kinds of activities. Also, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure I understood. Two-thirds of the 30%? Is that what you said? Two-thirds of the 30% go back to prison? And if they've committed another felony, why do they not? What happens there? Where do you lose a third of them?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hannah, many felonies don't result in a prison sentence. So they might be convicted of a new crime and receive a probation sentence. They're serving along with their post-prison sentence, but they remain in the community on supervision.
I see. Thank you.
Also, correctional programs within the prisons and in the field are now being assessed for compliance with this same body of research that tells us how best to reduce recidivism through the requirements of Senate Bill 267. As an example, Multnomah County has been looking to this research and redesigning their system now for its big system, so it takes a long time to make changes, but they've been consistently at this for 6 or 7 years now, and looking at their recidivism data over the last 3 years, we are seeing a consistent downward trend for them, and that has not historically been true. Multnomah County's had a difficult time meeting the benchmarks for recidivism, so I know there are many factors that contribute to recidivism, but one has to look at those two things happening together, that comprehensive system change, research to practice, and a reduction of recidivism, and I'm certainly hoping we see that same kind of thing reflected in the statewide numbers. Major budgetary issues, we've identified two for transitional services. One, obviously, is the growth in the caseload. All of our caseloads are expected to grow. They will grow more slowly in the field, a little quicker in the prison. Also, the interstate compact with the new rules. We are now responsible for misdemeanants from other states who are being moved into Oregon under the compact. So that's a growth in caseload that we didn't anticipate and isn't one we've had in the past. The second major issue has to do with the community corrections opt-out under the governor's budget. County agencies, county governments could make the decision to opt out of participating in the Community Corrections Act. That doesn't change the overall statewide budget, but it certainly impacts the agency administrative functions that the Department of Corrections becomes responsible for and could result in reduced services at the local level as we take some administrative dollars out of those county allocations. I think we covered the governor's proposal on the new budget building model. I didn't know if you folks wanted to.
Any questions?
Continue to look at that. Skipping now to page 19, where we discuss budget notes. There were three budget notes that were assigned to the Transitional Services Division. One is to evaluate the effectiveness of community corrections in each county and to work with the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision on that effort, to evaluate particularly the impact of revocations and sanctions on individual county rates, identify best practices, and share that information with county agencies. We did do that data analysis looking for some connection between revocation, sanctions, and recidivism. We did not find a connection between those two activities, which is really expected since we know from the reducing recidivism research that you have to pair some kind of correctional intervention along with the treatment if you want to make a difference in recidivism. So we next surveyed counties who had the lowest rates of recidivism and asked them for their hypotheses about why that was so, tested the ones that we could, and then shared that information out with each community corrections agency. Later, we surveyed the agencies to determine actions they had taken to implement best practices. And so they mentioned things like focusing officer time on the highest risk offenders, assessing criminal risk factors, increasing coordination between the various agencies in the community that were touching the lives of folks under supervision. Several of them pointed to requiring the application of evidence-based practices in the correctional programs with whom they contract, using mentors and drug-free housing, and focusing on employment, getting people to treatment, and building pro-social support. Those were some of the things that counties said they were doing to reduce recidivism. The second budget note that we were given had
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were analyzing the differences between counties, were there any patterns that showed up, like lower recidivism rates in rural counties versus urban counties, or some characteristics that any general patterns that showed up?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hansen, we have come through that data looking for those kinds of trends, you know, again and again, and we haven't been able to determine any particular characteristic of a county that you could say, where you see this, you'll see lower recidivism, where you see this, you'll see higher recidivism. We simply aren't able to find those kinds of trends. I think partly because recidivism is such a multifaceted sort of measure. I mean, it gives you a basic idea of how your system is doing, And of course, you hope that when you do something, you can see it in the data. But there are so many factors that impact that data. It is sometimes hard to find absolute meaning in it.
I think one of the huge ironies is a basic question is that higher recidivism rate. Well, firstly, you could dramatically lower the recidivism rate if you cut back on law enforcement. Now, if you stop arresting people, or if you don't have cops on the street, or you don't have parole officers looking at closely supervising people, that doesn't lower the crime rate. Of course, it only or the other way is to get people reformed and doing a better job and working and being an active part of society. And a lot of times when I look at those numbers, I'm not sure which one of the two I'm looking at.
If I could, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, that the recidivism rate is an interesting one. We're sort of the guardian of that as a performance measure, but we certainly hope that the committee understands that we have a limited impact. We can certainly do what we can do with transitioning people effectively back to community and providing program, but as you point out, there are a number of different factors that affect that rate, and increased law enforcement or increased supervision at the local level will ultimately determine some higher number of people who may be in violation of their post-prison supervision and may be revoked or found offending and returned. So we share that rate substantially with all of our other public safety partners, we believe, because at every level there is an impact. The point is, as Ms. Martin made, is that it is a trend that I think is, if things stay generally equal, gives you some sense of whether you're going up or whether you're going down, and whether the things that you're working on are helping drive that number down. And in that respect, we think it's a good measure for us to continue to monitor and continue to report to the committee on.
Senator Devlin?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Have we ever looked at the recidivism rate in two different areas? One in terms of you actually have, in a sense, two different types of individuals that end up being inmates at your institutions. Those that have been there before and those that have never been there before. Now, obviously, in both of those cases, they may have done county time before. But have we looked at what the recidivism rate is for the offender doing the first state time versus the offender that's basically coming back again? I mean, we don't have as much of the sort of, and I know there's different debates about this, we don't have as much of the revolving door that we used to have. I mean, I can remember a time when burglary, multiple convictions, put you in for maybe 10 months, 18 months, but you went out, at least the people I knew that were in the institution, they went out, worked for 2-3 years at the profession, were caught again, did their 12 months, came back in again. But have we looked at recidivism rate from the standpoint of, you know, those people that have never been in, done state time versus those people that have been in before?
Chair Gourley, Senator Devlin, people who have been in prison before do have higher rates of recidivism than those who haven't. I don't, off the top of my head, know the exact difference between the two. We certainly have that data available.
But I would say that those actually tend to skew your number higher in terms of your judgment at the end, because those people that have recycled through the system several times are pushing up your number. I think there are a lot of people that do 5 years or 7 years in a state facility and don't come back.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the majority of folks who come to prison don't come back.
No.
The second budget note that we were given had to do with reviewing the use of fees by local community corrections programs. And we were asked to analyze the different fee structures used and the variance between counties, to look at the proportion of fee revenue to total costs and the collection rates. And so we did that. Every county collects a supervision fee, a monthly fee. That ranges from $25 to $40 per month. Other counties are charging fees for various other kinds of activities, which you'll find listed there on page 20. Some counties do charge fees for some of these. Some counties charge fees for all of them. Some counties don't charge any of these kinds of fees. But altogether, counties collect 4.4% of their total revenue in fees, and on average, they're collecting 50% of the fees that they charge. The third budget note that we had.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Of Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I don't understand. So what? Collected the information, and I'm sorry, I don't understand your last two statements that state average has 4.4% of total revenue for community corrections is derived from fees, and that an average of 50% of fees charged are collected. I thought this was money the counties are charging you for the inmates. Is that?
Chair Gorley, Representative Wisnett. No, these are fees charged to offenders on supervision. The committee last session was interested in the types of fees that different jurisdictions were charging, and what difference was that making in the resources that they had available.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you didn't say we're going to standardize. You're going to let the counties that they're going to charge different amounts, or
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, we typically respect local decision making in terms of how they manage their system and the kinds of local resources they invest.
Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I think the interest was that I think the perception and maybe reality, I don't know, some counties were much more aggressive in charging fees and collecting than other. I can give you some data that was put together by community corrections directors about 8-9 months ago, I think. Show you sort of the differences, and it's not only fees that vary significantly. Some counties put substantial amount of their general fund revenues in the community corrections program. Some put virtually nothing in. So you have some local programs that have lots of local funds, and you have some that have very little other than fees in them. And I can share that information with you.
So let me follow up, Madam Chair, so I understand. So these are people in the counties that are parole, under supervision, parole officers.
Right.
And they have to be checked for drug use, so they're getting that test. And we're trying to charge them that much money.
The county, Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, is charging, not the state.
Okay.
Except for those counties that the state administers, Douglas and Linn County. And then the state would be the responsible party since they're administrator of that county program.
And I would still, Madam Chair, wonder why we tasked them to do that and we're not going to use the data or we're not putting it out.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, this gets back to sort of a philosophical discussion about 1145 and the idea of community corrections being a county-based model. Part of the original agreement was that there would be a fair amount of free hand given to the counties to determine how they set their priorities, where they want to invest their resources, and how they want to run their system. So you do have somewhat of a patchwork, certainly within the purview of the legislature to make changes to that kind of a model and give direction, but I don't think under the current approach that the department necessarily would be in the position to, as it's currently structured, to go tell these counties what kind of fees they ought to be charging for a particular service that they're or a particular activity.
Please go forward.
Our third budget note was to plan to evaluate the success of substance abuse and cognitive programs, and I try to provide that status of that information as I went through those parts of our budget. We are, as I said, engaging in the more sound research, I guess, in the prospective studies now on the alcohol and drug programs, which should give us a more confidence in the results. I had prepared a few comments on Senate Bill 267. Madam Chair, would you like me to continue? And
if you would, please.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 267, as you probably know, was enacted in 2003. Brilliantly enacted, I'll say. To promote more consistent and effective correctional programming, and also to make sure that we were investing wisely in state dollars and correctional programs. And so the law directed that any program that was designed to reduce the likelihood of someone to commit crimes or to reduce antisocial behavior leading to crime or to improve the mental health of a person should be evidence-based. So it's very far-reaching, involves five different state agencies. Within the Department of Corrections, we've looked at this implementation in two parts, the institution programs as one part and the community programs as the second part. The prison programs that need to comply with Senate Bill 267 are our alcohol and drug treatment programs, our cognitive programs, our parenting skills training, and our mental health care. We have chosen the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory as a fairly objective tool to determine if programs are being delivered consistent with the research, and we have applied that tool to our in-prison programs. Using that then as a way, as a baseline to improve the programs that we have. About half of our programs were satisfactory and the other half had some recommendations to bring them up to a satisfactory level.
Satisfactory?
The tool rates programs from unsatisfactory through several levels of satisfactory.
What are the levels?
They are very satisfactory, satisfactory, satisfactory needs improvement, and unsatisfactory. We are now proceeding to apply this same assessment tool to community-based programs. We are looking then in the community at the same kinds of programs, alcohol and drug programs, cognitive programs, parenting programs, mental health, sex offender treatment, domestic violence intervention programs, employment programs, anger management, and life skills programs. So we have redefined duties and several of the staff within the department to learn to use this tool and then to go out and apply it. I think that it's actually going pretty well. It's been well received, at least by community corrections directors. They are anxious to get this kind of information on the programs with whom they contact. Within the department, we've found the information to be extremely valuable in knowing clearly what kinds of improvements we might be making in the programs that we have, and we are now making those improvements. For example, we are looking at a range of cognitively based addictions treatment programs that are consistent with this research so that we can consistently apply. And then the second part of the Senate Bill 267 was to determine the cost effectiveness, and that's an area that we are working with the five agency state level group so that we have a consistent way of determining cost effectiveness. But of course, first we need to look at whether the program is being delivered consistent with research and then determine if it is also cost effective. So that's sort of a phase two. The law requires us to report in September of next year whether at least 25% of our resources invested in correctional programs in both the prison and the community are invested in evidence-based programs. And I don't really have any concern that we can't reach that 25%. In fact, I imagine by next September we should be pretty well along our way to a much higher percentage. Certainly within the institutions, we can get very close to 100%, I think, by then. And then the community, I think, will find a little bit more variability. Let's go forward. Okay. That actually concludes my portion of the budget presentation.
Would you, under proposed legislation, it indicates that no legislation affecting the budget has been proposed. Would you say that an exception to that would be Senate Bill 704 regarding mental health medications?
Madam Chair, I think I'll see if Director Williams can answer that question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senate Bill 704 was not a DOC bill, and so our reference here in the materials to propose legislation was to try to identify for the committee any legislation that the Department of Corrections was proffering that would have an impact on the budget. So the testimony you have on Senate Bill 704 was simply a response to a bill that was filed after the session began, and that was the department's was asked to provide information about the bill, and that's contained in Senate Bill 704. So I wouldn't say that that's specifically related to our budget or directly, except to the extent that we identify that there would obviously be an impact if Senate Bill 704 was passed.
Impact meaning increased costs.
That's right.
For the department.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Martin?
Madam Chair, at this time, with your pleasure, would like to bring up Assistant Director Shalit Honeywell, who is our Assistant Director of Human Resources, to give you a brief overview on the Human Resources Division of the Department.
Good afternoon. Chair Gordley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shalit Honeywell. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department overseeing the Human Resources Division. This afternoon, I'd like to just briefly take you through the division's proposed budget, identifying the subunits, and hopefully answering a few questions that I understand came up yesterday. The Human Resources Division is responsible for all aspects of the Department of Corrections employee services. In doing so, we really serve the organization. We need to be able to take on the challenges of the growing workforce along with the organization as it changes. Some of those units that are under the division are recruitment and career services, payroll and personnel records, human resource services and labor relations, staff training and employee development, classification and compensation, employee safety and risk management, along with, most recently, we also have a diversity manager that's also with our recruitment staff. On page 3, it's just indicated that the 0305 approved budget was a total of 50 positions, and we are seeking, as noted on page 4, 66 positions within the division.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are those new positions coming out of the ones that came in, the 60 positions from Land and Vent and was it Douglas? Or are they new ones you're asking for funding?
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, those are new positions. Those are new positions really associated with the growth of the department, both with the expansions of Coffee Creek and Shutter Creek, Madras and Lakeview. Although taking on additional duties associated with, since we did take on 48 positions in Douglas and Linn County.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So your diversity manager is where on the organizational chart?
Chair Gordley, our recruitment and career services manager is also our diversity manager.
All right. Thank you.
A brief overview, really, of the programs and services provided under the division. On page 5, we'll start with recruitment and career services. Recruitment and career services really is responsible for all the recruitment activities that goes on with regards to the department. DAS has approximately 800 classifications that they use to classify different types of position in state government. The department uses about 140 of those job classifications, hiring people to fit the needs of the department. This section of the division attends job fairs to educate and recruit new employees. We have a strong web presence. We represent ourselves at colleges, high schools, in classrooms, working with various groups, agencies, the military, minority organizations, and other groups seeking viable applicants to come work for the Department of Corrections. Also, it's on an ongoing analysis. We determine what's the appropriate staffing levels at institutions, knowing when we need to go out and recruit, when we need to help assist both institutions and operations and all the divisions in the organization to meet their staffing needs. I would like to note a particular interest here is the fact that we have an approximate 7 to 8% turnover rate. We pride ourselves in the Department of Corrections knowing that really on average in state government a lot of times you see close to a 10% turnover rate. However, if we look to other public sector Department of Corrections across the United States, it's an approximate 15% turnover rate. So we feel that recruitment and career services is really functioning well for the department and able to recruit individuals that stay long with the department. Turning to page 6, just noting a couple of the factors that actually influence the quality and delivery of the services associated with recruitment and career services is that we are in a lot of remote locations throughout the state, and sometimes we find it difficult to recruit in those areas. Along with the fact that we've taken on the addition of county community correction programs in trying to provide two unique services and different types of applicants. Another thing to note is the Department of Corrections has the most state employees that have been called up on military deployments. There's about 100 individuals that are out on military service out of state government currently, and approximately 50% of those are actually Department of Correction employees. Moving on to payroll and personnel.
Before you do that,
yes.
What are some of the strategies you have used to overcome the difficulties in recruiting in those remote local locations?
Chair Cordley, I think some of the best strategies that we've used is actually creating a true local presence, partnering with local chamber of commerce, local businesses, being a part of the community that we're serving and operating and functioning in. Along with, for example, in our Eastern Oregon institutions, both Ontario and Pendleton, we go to the local community colleges, make a presence there, so that we're really seeking applicants that are coming out of either two-year or four-year programs in corrections.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I'd like to introduce to the committee and to the chair, Mayor Rick Allen's in the back from Matters. He may want to comment on his efforts to recruit, or he's probably here just being sure we stay on target here. So if you haven't met the mayor.
Welcome. It's good to see you there. And you can sit up front.
Okay.
Glad to have you. Thank you.
I'll be here tomorrow.
Wonderful. Look forward to hearing you. Please go forward.
One other something I'd also like to note with regards to recruitment and career services, with our diversity manager, the department most recently actually creating a diversity manager, having a position that really functions within the department-wide, focusing on diversity issues. That we know it's important in our remote locations to focus on that, and we just turned into our affirmative action plan with the governor's office, knowing that it's important to, again, partner in our areas outlying, just not in the valley, with regards to minorities in those areas. So we're actively seeking that and seeking those individuals in those areas also. Now moving on to payroll and personnel records, the payroll unit's responsible for processing of the agency-wide payroll functions for almost 4,000 employees in compliance with the Department of Administrative Services and the State Controller's Division Rules, Policies, and Procedures. This unit deals with all payroll issues, leave time, insurance benefits, safe claim processing as it relates to payroll. It maintains all the retirement information that's critical to our employees and resolves exceptions to ensure that proper payment occurs to our employees on a weekly, biweekly, and monthly basis, depending on what kind of payroll we're running at the time. Also, we have personnel records staff that's responsible for maintaining the Department's of Corrections employee position and medical files. For almost 4,000 employees, we are a paper system at this point in time, and we process all employee and position-related changes throughout the department. I would note that we had approximately about 1,000 changes in position management last year that this group oversees. They also provide technical assistance. And working in conjunction with employees and also our human resource analysts to ensure compliance with the Department of Corrections policies and the Department of Administrative Services policies. The next section is the Human Resources and Labor Relations Unit in the division. the Human Resources and Labor Relations Unit's responsible providing the professional level services for human resources throughout the department. They provide advice, guidance, training, negotiations, interpretation, and applications of multiple collective bargaining agreements. We have 5 total for the department. The human resources team, they work together to provide really a streamless providing HR services for the department. They also partner with the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Justice, and other areas of government so that they're providing really best practices for human resources for the department.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Mrs. Boykin's not here, so I hope she'll hear this question. But at our tour of the state prison, it was mentioned that the guards, there's 2 different unions that are representative, and that does not permit us to transfer guards from certain prisons to the other to help with personnel problems. Is that the case, and is there any effort to try to solve that?
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, we do have 2 different unions, both AFSCME and also the Association of Correctional Officers called AOCE. And so it's true that we do have 2 separate organizations that represent our security officers for the department. And so it would be considered crossing bargaining unit lines when we do try to transfer positions. I think one of the current proposals on the table, one of our issues has always been around seniority. The association actually accepts the seniority of AFSCME-represented employees throughout the department, and AFSCME, up to this point, their contract didn't allow for the seniority to carry over. So also employees have chosen not to move themselves, much less our some of our struggles around moving positions to benefit the department where we need positions.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Woodward. So, like the military situation, you can't move from one facility under one union to the other, or they can't do that on a temporary basis or anything. Is that correct?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, that is correct. It's not as simple as just moving a position or an individual. Again, it would be giving notice and going through a proper notification process and system to make that happen.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the situation you're probably describing are the 2 facilities at the penitentiary, the minimum, which is an AFSCME bargaining unit, and the penitentiary itself, which is an AOCE institution. The contract doesn't allow the superintendent of that facility or one of the managers of that facility, if someone calls in sick or down for some reason at one facility, to transfer a similar classified position over to the other institution to backfill. And it is contract language and a part of the bargaining process, and it's an issue that we are continuing to raise to try to improve the operations of the department, but something obviously that we have to sit down with our labor partners and have a conversation with as we go through the bargaining process. And you can understand from the union perspective, they're not terribly excited about the idea of crossing bargaining unit lines and having management have the ability to redirect staff. And it's a fairly strongly felt issue on the part of labor, and I assume you understand their rationale for that, given the business that they're in.
I do have a question, though, understanding and appreciating what you said. The current arrangement comes with costs. What are those costs, so that we have that understanding as well?
Madam Chair, I think it would be difficult. We could attempt to put a number on it. It would be difficult to assess what those costs are. They would primarily demonstrate themselves, I would assume, in issues, for example, in overtime, where someone can't cross bargaining unit lines, and therefore you have to bring someone in on overtime to cover a shift. It might be difficult to assess that. We know from an operational standpoint that it impinges our ability, and that there is some amount of cost associated with that.
But
I don't know that
there's not been an attempt to really assess that piece.
No, I don't think we've netted it out to a specific number, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Continuing on, I probably would note just one last thing about the Human Resource Services and Labor Relations unit, and that is they're really tasked with working both with management and employees to work through all disciplinary actions and investigations, grievances, and torts in the department. Moving on to staff training and employee development. I understand that there were some questions around training yesterday that I'd like to actually attempt to answer today. But first, just briefly, this unit provides the following levels of classroom and applied training, and that is we have a new employee orientation that's comprised of a 40-hour program, and it introduces all the department staff to a career in the Department of Corrections. It's really important through new employee orientation that we outline the Department of Corrections actual policies, our expectations, what it is to be an employee with the department. It allows individuals that go through this training to meet a lot of managers, higher-level executives throughout the department, hearing from them firsthand the expectations of the department. We also have an annual in-service training that's comprised of a 40-hour program, and each year it's redesigned to meet really the current needs of the department. Most recently, we're dealing with more issues on mental health. We deal with basic security practices. They receive defensive tactics and also firearm qualifications during this 40-hour week. We also include always a message with regards to the Oregon Accountability Model during this training. We also have a component that is trained on with regards to leadership development, and this is an additional 16 to 24 hours of training, management training for the organization. We most recently just hired a leadership manager in this unit to focus on training and developing our management staff in the department. There's also an instructor development and certification as we perform a lot of this training. It is important that we have instructors that are certified to do CPR, first aid, forest skills courses, et cetera. And lastly, there's training and records and course documentation that this unit is in charge of, and they track all employee records for training and maintain them for the department. My understanding is yesterday that there were some questions with regards to the DPSST training and how many hours was that, some comparators to other states, and if Madam Chair, if you'd like, I would like to maybe try to answer some of those questions at this time.
Please.
One of the questions, I believe, was with regards to just comparing ourselves with other states, how many hours of basic training that we go through at DPSST to maybe some of our comparators. We currently provide, our DPSST provides 200 hours, 5 weeks of training. It is considered basic corrections training that all correctional officers do have to go through and pass to become certified to work in the department. The state of Washington provides 160 hours, while we can go, the state of Idaho, I believe, provides 400, the state of California, 640 hours. So you can see that there's a broad range of the number of hours being provided for that basic level of training before they become a correctional officer or a peace officer that in some other states and what they're called. Also, I just wanted to maybe share some differences with regards to why the department would take on its own training program and train at a level that's above and beyond the basic level training. I hit on it a little bit with regards to our new employee training and orientation. It's important that we note that our security staff go through DPSST, but all non-security or what we call security plus within the organization do not receive that certification. So it's important through new employee orientation that we provide basic security practices. We provide use of force skills, inmate supervision, safety on communicable diseases. We also, again, provide instruction necessary that's not generic in nature that DPSST provides around the correctional field, but that's very specific to the Department of Corrections and the type of work we do and the expectations we have of our employees. So I hope maybe that delineates or distinguishes a little bit between the two types of training that's occurring in the basic level and what we do on an ongoing basis.
Representative Wisnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give us the number of people that you're planning to send to DPSS to Department of Public Safety and Standards Training each year. And okay, so how many do you send each year? You recruit, you know, each recruit has to go. And is there, you don't send them back after they're certified, and are they, after they go through this training, the PSST, are they able to go online at that time?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I don't know the exact number. I know that we had across the organization in this last biennium about 1,000 new hires that occurred. I think that 80% of our organization, I would be guessing about 80% of them, is in the correctional series. If all of those were new and never obtaining any basic certification at this point, that would approximate about 800 individuals in a biennium. So those are just some rough numbers. I would be more than happy to bring actual numbers back to you.
Madam Chair, follow. Yeah, I'm still, and Senator Devlin and I talked offline afterwards. I'm not trying to get rid of your training program. I'm just trying to understand this concept where we've come up with this new training facility, and I cannot believe you haven't talked about how much workload you're giving. We're building this facility, and it's going to have to be staffed and fully equipped and all this, and you don't know how many people you're going to send there each year.
And Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, I think they, in the projections that they've done, they have an estimate given to some degree what they can know about what we do. Ms. Honeywell commented, when we've had a large number of people leave for retirements or some other purpose, and then we go through a spate of additional new hires, or in the example of us opening up the Warner Creek facility in Lakeview, where there will be a number of new people hired on to the department who've never been trained before, they certainly plan, and we provide them information, and they forecast to some degree how many bodies they anticipate they're going to get. Their correctional officer training, however, is not simply state-specific. So in the classes that are taught at DPSST for correctional officers, you might have, and I've attended and actually spoke at a graduation ceremony there, you might have in a class of 60 or 70 people, a third of them might be Department of Corrections employees slated to go at the 12 institutions around the state. The balance of the two-thirds may be county correctional officers who will be working in the jail, and they are in the same correctional class and move through together. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we do our new employee orientation training when they come on board, is because what DPSST teaches is generally applicable across the correctional spectrum, but there is a different kind of an approach to a jail management situation versus, as I'm sure Senator Devlin could tell you, a longer-term prison population management, along with what the larger values of the Department of Corrections are with respect to our mission, vision, and values about recidivism and the Oregon accountability model. Those items are covered to a greater degree in our own training. So we do work closely with DPSST. We talk quite a bit with them about issues involving both where and how many people are going to be involved in the training. As new correctional officers, we have conversations with them about improving and updating their curriculum to address particular issues that we might be dealing with, and we have a very positive working relationship with them. It's clear that they struggle, obviously, with the resources they have to be all things to all people, and so the level of basic correctional class they put on has to be a class that is as meaningful to someone who may be coming on as a brand new correctional officer in Klamath County as it is somebody that we're going to be sending to work in our Columbia River facility in Portland.
I think what's still fuzzy for me is, and I appreciate the information that you've provided, Ms. Honeywell, around the hours provided through DPSST, and then something else that happens through the Department of Corrections. In addition to understanding the hours, comparing and contrasting to other states, et cetera, it's the content. What is the curriculum and the content as it applies to DPSST? What is the curriculum and content as it relates to what the Department of Corrections provides? And then what are the differences? What are the nuances within that? And you may not be prepared to respond to that question today, but that's the kind of unpacking I think we're trying to do around the training piece and having a deeper understanding of what it is. Not just the hours, but what's the content?
And Madam Chair, in the material that we intend to provide you in response to your questions yesterday, we'll provide an outline of the curriculum, not only for DPSST, but for our new employee orientation, as well as for our 40 hours of in-service that we're providing to all employees during the 2005 period. So we'll give you all of that curriculum information so you get at least a sense of the classes. And to the extent the committee has additional questions about particular portions of that curriculum, we're happy to review it.
And let me check in with Representative Lisnett. Does that get at the kind of detail that you're still trying to
Yes, ma'am. I think we don't want to be duplicating training, and we're not trying to take away your need to be specific in some of your training. One follow-up question, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
When you employ someone who needs to go to DPSST, is he on the payroll from the time then during training is he on the payroll or only after he passes the training?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, there are employees. It's a required training that we're sending them to with regards to being their employer, and therefore they're being paid during that time.
Okay. And then the last question we can leave, Madam Chair, is I think when Director Minnis comes back, I mean, I can understand if we bring a new person on, that's going to be a big training load. But I don't understand how based upon the conversation we've had in the State Police and the Corrections, how Mr. Minnis has designed his training program, his staff. I hope we're not going to be working 1 month and down 3 months or however that's going to all come together. I'm just not sure I understand the concept yet. We tried to schedule a tour out there, and we're not able to come up with a tour yet. So, but thank you for allowing me to pursue that.
Oh, certainly. We need to continue to get the fullest possible understanding, and I'm sure that the questions are going to come up again when we get to a couple of our other budgets. Homeland Security comes to mind. Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair. Ms. Honeywell, 4,000 employees, is that about right? Is that what you said? 4,000
yes.
Employees, 80% of them corrections, 3,200, 8% turnover rate, 300 and some. That'd be about the number that you're going to train as correctional officers. I mean, if you just kind of did the rough math, right? I mean, you're going to run those that you're replacing. I mean, to what Representative Wisnett said, this is never going to be a static number. It's always going to be a fluid number. Bring on a new facility, you're going to get a bump. Stay with the same facilities for some time. Have the turnover rate somewhat static, you're going to have a normal turnover rate that you're going to train. So I think you could have planning for the number of people you're going to train. I mean, you're going to look out ahead sometime and you're going to have a new facility and say it's going to take X amount, but for planning purposes, I think you could probably come up with a number of, using good numbers that you'd have a pretty good shot at hitting.
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, keep in mind that what Director Williams said, roughly maybe a third of a basic training class is the DOC. You have that other large number of Multnomah County, Klamath County, which are probably experience the same kind of turnover rates that are varying. So the larger the base population, probably the more it smooths out over time.
Probably the more accurate they can plan, actually, because it spreads the base out.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think for a facility like Lakeview, you're looking at training a little differently. DPSS is still doing it, but there was some discussion sometime about doing it elsewhere than the DPSST facility, if I'm not mistaken.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Wilson,
you're adding a wrinkle, you realize.
and we're involved in conversations with DPSST about that. That's obviously, for them, it's a substantial operational issue. For us, it's the potential of some savings by having them locate training more closely, approximating the location of the facility, and we'll continue to talk with them about what ultimately works best. We view them as an important and valuable partner, and we have a good, positive working relationship with them.
To be continued.
Madam Chair, if I may continue. Thank you. Just briefly, the last two units within the division is classification and compensation. And again, they're tasked with making sure that all of our positions that we have within the division are appropriately classified and therefore our employees are appropriately being paid associated with that classification. And then also safety and risk management. This unit is responsible for developing safety and risk policies and programs based on federal and state law rules and establishing risk reduction strategies for the entire department. Really briefly, we do have some professional services and purchasing contracts identified on page 9. One is our security recruiting screening tool contract that we use with American Trust Corps. We use both a work style behavior survey and also a correctional officer test while we're doing our recruitment for the correctional series. We have a health services contract associated with providing a number of health care providers throughout the state to administer physicals for those individuals coming in as new employees to the department, and then a couple of training delivery contracts. Under cost control measures, again, the Human Resources Division is administered primarily centrally, and we've done that to be most cost-effective for the department and utilizing the staff that we do have. But when it's important, we do deploy them to the institutions, especially on the east side, so that we can have our best customer service associated with that institution. We've also changed using some alternative training methodologies, specifically computer-based training, web-based training, to be more effective. And again, we have centralized our recruitment activities. We do have one performance measure associated with this division, and that is our workers' compensation time loss claim measure. This measure is the rate of workers' compensation time loss claims per 100 employees on a fiscal year basis. That really means the number of claims themselves. It's not assessing or looking at the number of hours or how much time loss was actually paid. The target for 2004 was 1.0. Our data for 2004 was 1.52. And our target for 2007 is 1.3. We're not really seeing a continuing downward trend we've experienced prior to this. We're growing as an organization, and we seem to see more time loss claims originating out of basic lifting, trips, falls, kind of basic things and basic risks associated within the institution. A couple of the major budgetary issues, again, is that inmate population growth is leading to our employee growth within the department and therefore has an impact on the services that the Human Resources Division provides for the department. Again, the budget details will be provided by Sue Acuff, and we had no budget notes associated with this division. And thank you for your time.
Chair, just quickly, you yes. had someone, and I think it actually was the chair, had wished for a performance measure to be sort of studied about around staff training.
Mm-hmm.
So just to note that.
And Madam Chair, again, we've been working on some of those very discussions and intend to provide you that in the material that we will provide in answer to the questions that were developed yesterday, give you an idea of some of the various management measures we're currently considering on staff and professional development.
Thank you, Director Wimps. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ms. Honeywell.
You're welcome.
At this time, with the Chair's approval, I bring forward John Koreski, who is our Assistant Director of General Services. And you'll find a General Services tab in your notebook directly behind Central Administration.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Koreski, Assistant Director for General Services for the Department of Corrections. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to provide you with an overview of the General Services Division. As a lead-in to that, before I get into a little more detail, I'd like to outline some observations about General Services, if I might. First, General Services' fundamental role is that of a service provider. Our services align with the business functions performed by our customers in the institutions, administrative offices, and community corrections operations. Second, the division strives to strike a critical balance between providing a direct service using a central support model and coordinating with work units across the department for those services that are better delivered in a decentralized manner. And third, the growth in staff and resources has not always stayed consistent with the growth of the prison system. So we're continually looking for ways to improve efficiency to compensate in our operation. If you turn to page one, I'd like to provide you with a brief overview of the division. The division is comprised of four units: information services, distribution services, facility services, and fiscal services. General services provide services that are fundamental to the day-to-day operations of the department, including access to information, procurement of goods and services, inventory of critical assets, accounting for dollars spent, maintenance and renovation of our existing facilities, timely distribution of goods, and our fixed asset management. General services is dedicated to providing efficient and cost-effective services, timely delivery of goods and services, and maintaining a tie to state agency operations to ensure the department's ongoing involvement in statewide enterprise initiatives. You'll turn to page two. On page two and three, there you'll see a comparison of the organization charts between 03 and 05 and the 05-07 biennium. What you'll note there is that there's a net difference of 21 positions, 21 additional positions in the 05-07 biennium. The majority of those positions are actually coming on with the build-out of the institutions in Madras, Warner Creek, and the expansion at Coffee Creek. There are two additional positions that we're asking for in a policy option package to support our central telephone support. Moving on to page four. Programs and services. I'd like to talk about each of the. Give you a little more detail about each of the individual units within the division. First is distribution services unit. They're the primary logistical support operation for the department, managing statewide inventory of expendable and non-expendable inventory. Food service standards for feeding inmates is part of their responsibility. They develop standard menus, manage food product inventories and transport of these goods to institution kitchens, and manage the inmate canteen program. They log somewhere in the neighborhood of about 240,000 miles in a year, delivering about 15,000 pallets of food. We have over 14 million in food sales, supporting about 13 million meals annually. Facility Services is responsible for overseeing the ongoing support of our existing facilities. That's about 300 buildings and over 4 million square feet that they administer and repair maintenance program for those existing institutions by helping set priority for deferred maintenance, set standards for building materials, and develop common operating procedures. They also manage our leased facilities. The Fiscal Services is the central body responsible for supporting the financial activities of the department. So they're involved in our central accounting of all financial transactions. They manage the inmate trust and canteen accounting systems, provide support for contract and procurement management. They also prepare the department's financial report for statewide comprehensive annual financial reporting. They process some of the neighborhood in our accounting section, 57,000 documents annually. This would include checks, invoices, vouchers, those kinds of things. They manage in our on the trust side, they make somewhere in the neighborhood of about 150,000 deposits for our roughly 13,000 inmates that we have incarcerated. The Information Services Unit.
Before you go there, Mr. Koreski, the most recent fiscal audit, Secretary of State's audit, what was the date on that?
Madam Chair, I believe the one you're probably referring to is the audit that had to do with taking a look at the upgrade of our financial system. The findings for that came out right about the end of 2004, or the beginning of 2005, actually, were officially posted.
And are there any... Well, I'll ask Mr. Wilson, any findings, recommendations that would have meaning application when we get to session?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm not sure if there's any specific items that the subcommittee would address mm-hmm. necessarily, except that I think the department would say that the growth they have in the fiscal services in terms of the staff, I think they're requesting 7 additional positions, I think it was, would help them along in addressing some of the issues that they would that came out of that audit.
If I could, Madam Chair, just maybe footnote for the committee this point. What the audit essentially said was that there were particular procedural aspects of the operations in our fiscal office that needed to be enhanced. And those were the recommendations of the audit, which we agreed with. In doing my review of their recommendations and looking back at some history, what I at least determined was that the department had more than doubled in size, the number of inmates and the number of institutions and the number of employees in about a 10-year period of time, but we had not made any investment in our fiscal services office with additional staff. So you had the same number of people doing twice the volume of work, and in some cases even more than twice the volume of work, with a level of complexity, if you think about our building and construction program during the 90s and the financing specifics and details and the accounting required for managing the various COP debt and how those are paid and accounted for, and it was clear that lack of investment over time had resulted in just frankly people not having enough bodies to do all of the work and dot all of the I's and cross all of the T's as the auditors would have liked us to have done. And so what you see, I think, in the recommendation and in the recommendations that we adopted from the Secretary of State is to implement with some new staff the coverage that we need to essentially respond to the issues that were raised in the Secretary of State's audit. And we believe we're well on our way in a number of directions in addressing those issues. But obviously those additional staff support are going to be key for us being ultimately successful in meeting that obligation.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Information Systems Unit is the central support and management for information assets deployed throughout the department and in our county community correction sites. They're responsible for managing and maintaining a computer network for over 5,000 users in 12 prison sites and 36 county parole and probation offices. They also develop and maintain software and databases that support our offender management for both the institutions and the community, budget and finance, and program evaluation. We also administer all department telephone systems, including the inmate telephone system, and that includes equipment management, bill management, and support for planned upgrades and additions. Turning now to page 5, focusing on the professional services and purchasing contracts, general services, largely for as far as professional services concerned, what we focus on there is providing those kinds of skills that we just don't have internally. For instance, when we're involved in a major expansion of an institution, we'd be going out for contracting help for architecture, engineering, and that kind of thing. On the information technology side, where we maybe have a major project going and we're looking for some outside quality assurance contracting advice, we would contract out for those kinds of services.
As far as purchasing contracts are concerned, we utilize state purchasing agreements for the purchase of things like janitorial supplies, some of our food item purchases, clothing, as well as computer hardware, software, and those kinds of items. Cost control measures. Within, I'm now on page 6. Cost control measures with respect to distribution services, we utilize a statewide warehouse to take advantage of buying food in bulk quantities. And this has allowed us to keep our food costs down to a budgeted average of about $2.30 per day per inmate. The Bureau of Justice Statistics has rated this as one of the lowest in the country. We also use inmate labor in the warehouse to, again, to keep some of our employee costs down. We manage and pick up, we pick up and deliver schedules to maintain full loads when our trucks are on the road. So we'll take a delivery out to Ontario from our warehouse, and we'll pick up some French fries or something to bring back to our warehouse and then distribute out from there. We also collaborate with other state agencies such as the Oregon Youth Authority and the Oregon State Hospital to purchase bulk items from them as well to help keep their costs down. Facilities services, again, looks at consolidating the purchasing of building materials, things like paint, cabling, and copper to help keep the materials costs down for repair of institutions. In information services, we do provide a central management for a telephone system, which has allowed us to reduce the cost for administering that system over what it previously was when that was handled in a more distributed manner. And the two positions that we're asking for have been limited duration positions that we've had for the last biennium that really have helped clean that system up and provide a lot of financial efficiency for us. Turning now to page 8, performance measures. We have one that's related to distribution services, and that has to do with the rate of, originally it was electrical consumption. We are now changing that to British thermal units so that we can more accurately gauge our energy usage, not just in terms of electricity, but electricity and gas usage as well. We have the measure that's out there right now. We have achieved that measure, and we'll be proposing to the Progress Board that we change that measure to British thermal units. Our major budgetary issues really fall into two major categories throughout all of the infrastructure that we help maintain. The first has to do with the aging infrastructure, and primarily you see that in our building sites. I know you all toured the Oregon State Penitentiary, which is, of course, one of our oldest facilities, and there are major repair issues there that we're trying always to keep up on top of. And then a couple of that really is the rising costs of all sorts of things. Energy costs, building materials is a big one. We've seen an average of 18% increase in the cost of building materials over the last couple of years. Rising food costs. Those are probably the two major categories of major budgetary concerns that we have to deal with on a daily basis. The next section, budget detail, I believe Ms. Acuff will be presenting that later.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it was our intent to allow you to review this, but this would be detail would cover again in work session at the request of staff, so we won't take you through it right now.
That's fine.
And with that we have no budget notes from the last session, so with that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you may have any.
Any questions or comments for Mr. Koreski? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your hard work in preparation for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last person I'd like to bring up in the remaining few minutes that we have left would be Deputy Director Mitch Morrow. This would be covering, you'd find this section under the tab Central Administration. Mr. Morrow is my deputy, and he'll be presenting essentially the Central Administration portion of the budget.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Corrections. And in respect for the time constraints here, what I'll do is move through rather quickly, but if there are questions, I'll obviously be happy to stop and respond to those. I'll be discussing specifically, as Director Williams pointed out, the central administration portion of your notebook. The central administration consists of seven separate sections. That's the deputy and the director's office, the public affairs, research and evaluation, planning and budget, project management, internal audits, and the inspector general's office. The primary focus of central administration is to enhance administrative effectiveness, accountability, and to strengthen our internal and external communications. We continue to be very good, or we are very good, at the incapacitation part of our mission statement. We continue to focus much more of our time on the side of our mission statement that deals with, in fact, the recidivism rate and ensuring that the folks that we do house in our institutions don't return back to the facilities upon their release. And so we spend a lot of time focusing on the Oregon accountability model, which you heard a lot about from the assistant directors and the other presenters, so I won't spend a lot of time on that. Flipping to page 3, that is the 0305 organizational chart. And then you can flip right to page 4 and see the changes, which is, in fact, an increase of about 14 positions to the 0507 organizational chart. The position changes came in internal audits with an increase of 1, inspector general's office with an increase of 7, and planning and budget with an increase of 6. And those increases are, for the most part, tied to construction activity and the growth in the department. I would also like to point out that you see at the top of the 0507 organizational chart the governor's advocate position. That position is no longer funded. Should not be on the 0507 form chart as you see it there. Second box would be the department overhead position that, because of the significance of the budget associated with the department overhead, we do recognize that on this respective organizational chart. Specifically, moving to page 5 of the different sections, again, it's the director and myself. Is the first section that we provide the vision, the policy direction, the overall leadership of the department, and we do that through obviously our executive management team, which are the managers of these different sections, and as well as the assistant directors that operate our divisions. The first section I'll talk about is the public affairs office. That is our direct link to the many media outlets that call and ask for information about the department. Multiple daily interaction with many different media folks occurs in that respective office, along with the fact that these folks track, I believe that they're tracking upwards of 462 legislative bills currently in this legislative session. They respond to, in a given year, upwards of 200 web-based inquiries, 180 responses on behalf of the governor, and that's some of that ombudsman work that we used to do for the ombudsman's office that now goes through our public affairs office. If, in fact, there's criminal elements or serious concerns associated with some of the inquiries you get, we pass that to our inspector general's office, and they follow up on that. They have responded to 450 requests for presentation materials and well over 1,000 requests for general information about the Department of Corrections. So that's a very busy office, and it consists of 4 people within the department. Stakeholders obviously consist of lawmakers, the governor's office, other government agencies, nonprofits, advocacy groups, inmate families, and again, the news media. The second area is research and evaluation. You've heard a lot about this particular section. They do provide us the information we need on mission-critical issues that we deal with day in and day out. I would tell you that early in my career, we did a lot of things because we thought it was the right thing to do. Today, we do things because it's research-based. We know it's right because we've done the analysis necessary to tell us it's right. And so I think we're in a better place organizationally. things that these folks have been involved with is currently they're involved in the evaluation of the AIP program. They are working very hard on profiling the types of inmates that involve themselves in attempted suicide or suicide issues. They monitor our risk issues around our institution operations. They look at high-risk behaviors by inmates, which ties back to HIV and things of that nature, and report back to us on what we can do to address those issues. They are evaluating the effectiveness of our community corrections programs. They're reviewing our classification system and obviously just doing an overall review of our programs, which you have heard discussed on the Senate Bill 267 issues. Moving to page 6. Planning and budget. This is the part of our agency that deals with the long-range construction planning that is in response to the growth of our system. They do manage all the construction programs and the actual construction projects themselves. They also are responsible for the management of our daily management of our budget. So that's the folks we go to keep us in line with our expenditure activity. And they do take the lead if we have to do any rebalance planning. And obviously, Sue and her staff play a significant role in the legislative process. The next office is the Projects Office. Again, another step in improving the sophistication of the Department of Corrections. This particular office, a two-person office, uses project methodology with regard to what we're going to be working on or what we're trying to get done as a department. They define the scope. They determine what resources are needed to get a project done. They'll outline who, what, where, and when, and then they'll execute the actual plan that we've decided on doing and then monitor the progress. These folks have worked on, again, the alternative incarceration program, the Going Home Project, which deals with security threat group inmates. They're involved with e-government project, facilitating work on the department's mental health task force. They did some work on our Prison Rape Elimination Act. They work with the Children of Incarcerated Parents Committee, and they actually spearheaded the director's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Mental Health. Very important office for us. They get a lot of things done. They keep us on track, and they make sure that we don't, again, just do things because somebody wants to do a project. They make sure we do things the right way and that we stay focused on getting it done. The next office, a four-person office, internal audits. They did 5 in-depth audits last year. They established an audit committee for the department. They manage all of our Secretary of State audits for us, and they've just recently completed a risk assessment for the Department of Corrections. This office is very important to Max and I would tell you that I believe there was a question that came up phase one about the separation of the Inspector General's office and the internal audits office. I would respond to that by saying that we didn't want to filter between ourselves and the internal auditor. We want the internal auditor to have direct access to our office to let us know where, in fact, the risks lie and what we're doing to address them as an agency.
Are there budget implications in the recent risk assessment?
Madam Chair, no, there's not. What they did is they walked through the department, identified those areas that we saw presenting significant risk to us. An example would be an escape risk on the operations side, any risk in the accounting section on the fiscal side. We're in the early stages of doing that. We're in the early stages of actually putting that together. We've, again, recently established the audit committee. The manager in charge of this unit is moving us to a level that I haven't seen, again, in my career with the department. And I think my initial review of the audit risk assessment process, I'm not seeing any costs associated with that. That's a long answer to your question.
Are there any, Director Williams, are there any currently any lawsuits pending against the department?
Oh, Madam Chair, I am sued on probably almost a daily basis, and a number of those lawsuits are inmate suits dealing with everything from the level of their incarceration to allegations of inappropriate behavior on the part of staff to a variety of other issues, habeas corpus filings where they are demanding release and the like. So there are multiple categories of items where the department is being sued. We have probably what I would say is sort of the normal personnel suits as well, where several staff are suing over various issues.
Would you provide us with a document that just lays out for us what that looks like.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Yeah, we'd be pleased to do so.
If there are potential risks there, you know, budget risk to the budget, also let us know that as well.
And we'd be happy to do that. I would tell you that in my sense currently is that we're not currently involved in specific litigation that would have major long-term implications for policy. In other words, occasionally a department will be involved in a matter that might reverse a particular position that may affect hundreds or even thousands of individuals. I'm not currently aware of any suit like that that's keeping me awake at night, Madam Chair, but there are a variety of other smaller items and we'll be pleased to provide the committee that information.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next office is the Inspector General's office. This office is comprised of three separate units, investigations, hearings, and rules. The investigations unit is a 22-person unit that last year conducted over 700 investigations and found themselves involved with some escapes from our minimum custody facilities, and I think it was a work crew escape. Busy office. They deal with all kinds of things from inmate inappropriate conduct to staff criminal conduct. So they're very busy. They're spread out across the state with offices in Salem, Umatilla, and Ontario. Looking to page 8, the next unit is the hearings unit. Consists of 8 hearings officers, and last year, again, they conducted 15,600 hearings. Throughout the department, they conduct disciplinary hearings, involuntary administrative segregation hearings, and involuntary special management unit hearings. This is the due process for the inmate population or for those particular inmates that decide to engage in inappropriate behavior. Last unit is the rules unit. It's a one-person unit, and it's a person that just basically ensures that all of our rules are up to date and in compliance with the standards that are in place currently today. Professional services and purchasing contracts. There's three examples here. The first one being our research and evaluation unit does have an educational research contract with Portland State University. And again, this is tied to research associated with Senate Bill 267. Second area that we have professional services or contracts is through the Inspector General's office. We do contract out our laboratory work for your analysis. And the third area is with the new prison construction, which uses professional services for the design and construction management of our building projects. If there's no questions, I'll move to page 9. Cost control measures, public affairs, and difficult to quantify, but you see the difference within the agency itself. Public affairs has expanded the use of electronic communication. There's a lot of people, and when you try to fill that stuff on paper, that's a lot of paper floating around the department. They now use, obviously, the email system and the web-based system to get information to our staff. Research unit with regard to evidence-based practices, I don't know that we've seen the return on that work yet, but definitely we're finding our way there with regard to making sure we do the programs that make the most difference. We don't want to continue to throw taxpayers' dollars at programs that are not working. The new construction program, this is easily quantifiable and a reflection of Ms. Acuff's shop. If you look at the last sentence of that particular paragraph under new construction, TRCI median facilities at $285 a square foot. Coffee Creek moved down to $283, and the current design of Madras is down to $261. And all those numbers reflect inflation. So I mean, the footprint has changed, and our learning from our construction work is I think ultimately saved the taxpayers a lot of money. Then finally, the investigations unit. We have just began. I can't give you the exact date we started, but we are now working very closely with some district attorneys and the state police. We are now conducting criminal investigations or limited criminal investigations in our institutions. I don't know that we see a significant change to our fiscal situation, but I know that freeing up detectives and district attorneys to do other work while we actually conduct the investigations on certain criminal issues will definitely save them some resources. So it's a partnership that took a long time to put together, but through a lot of conversation and with the director and the superintendent working very carefully and closely with each other, we were able to get this going. So it's exciting for the department. It's exciting for our investigations unit. I think ultimately it's the best way to go for the state. We don't have any performance measures specifically assigned to this particular unit. We're responsible for all of them. So if they're not working for the folks that I'm sure you'll be talking to. And last page, page 10, major budgetary issues. You've heard all this information, Madam Chair and members. Again, it's all tied to prison population and the growth in the department and the impacts that that come with that growth. So with that, and the fact that Ms. Acuff will be presenting the budget detail, I'll be happy to answer any questions. But, Madam Chair, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morrow. And, again, we thank you for your role in helping us with the tour of the Oregon State Prison.
My pleasure, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, with 1 minute to spare, I think we have given you at least the five major program area presentations. We recognize that some of this was a pretty high flyover. The individuals who presented today and previously stand ready to answer any questions, both individually, if that's the committee's preference, or more collectively, if the committee wants to schedule some additional time, or during the period that we present and walk through the work session. And we look forward to attending at least some of us tomorrow and listening to public testimony as well, and prepare to respond to any of those public inquiries as well.
Thank you very much, Director Williams. I would just like to say thank you to you and all of the staff who support your leadership. The presentations have been very good. I'm impressed with the professionalism of all the good folk that we've heard from thus far. And very much appreciate the timely responses to questions as we've been asking them. You folks are just great about getting back to us with very detailed information. But again, I just want to underscore the professionalism and the quality of participation before this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm blessed to have some very, very great people who work for the department.
And we will look forward to seeing you on tomorrow and in work session. Representative Wisnett.
I have some questions about you, from you or Senator Devlin or Doug. You know any about the? We're scheduled to be here at 4 and then we're leaving at 5 to go to. We understand there's a bus to take the full committee. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about the full committee arrangement. I can find out for you.
There are individual, I know that there's transportation available, but you'll need to check with, you received a notice in your office from legislative fiscal staff about how you want to handle your transportation needs.
I didn't get that.
For the full committee meeting.
It was, Madam Chair, it was an email that actually
an email?
Received.
Okay.
Now, I don't know, Madam Chair, for the relatively close hearings, if they're providing transportation or not. And the hearing at the Cascade is probably approximately 51
transportation
miles.
Is being provided for all of the meetings. You just need to look for the email, and they want a response by 5 p.m. today on what your transportation needs are. So I hope that helps a little bit. Again, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, committee members, and we're adjourned.